Former media baron and now jailhouse resident Conrad Black, who once suggested Linda should be, quote, horsewhipped. Black later hired McQuaig as a financial journalist at his newspaper, The Financial Post.
Now, I think you're probably expecting I'm going to go on and say some nasty things about Conrad Black, you know. And I have done that at various points in my life, but actually tonight I want to say something nice about Conrad Black. Yeah, you know, it's absolutely true that he has spent his whole life fighting against social justice, but I think he gives us hope because he's living proof that even a rich right-wing jerk can end up in jail, and that shows social justice is possible. I should point out, there are other books out there about the rise of the new rich, but they're a little bit different. They're often sort of all about how glamorous and exciting the lives of the rich are. And amazingly, you know, even in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008, we're still getting that kind of book. You know, there's a new book out about John Paulson. You know, he's that hedge fund manager who made $3.7 billion betting against the subprime mortgage market, you know, giving him the all-time record in history for profiting from the misery of others. Because really, his bet, his trade, as they call it, helped trigger the financial crisis with all the, of course, horrible repercussions that we're all still experiencing from that. Now, you might expect a journalist writing a book about this guy would have some critical things to say. But surprisingly, this book is extremely positive. He's portrayed as a hero. You get a sense from the title. It's written by a Wall Street Journal reporter, and the title of it is The Greatest Trade Ever. But, you know, that may be the view on Wall Street and on Bay Street and places like that. But our sense is that among ordinary people, the view is probably closer to those protesters who march down Wall Street carrying a placard saying, "Jump, you fuckers." So I guess I just want to clarify that you know, our book is more in the kind of "jump, you fuckers" genre of books about the rich. The extreme level of inequality that we see today, this incredible rise of income at the top, while the rest of the population has really been stagnant, I think that Canadians, by and large, don't really know that story. You know, essentially what's happened is all the income growth in the last three decades has gone to the top. It's gone to the top 10%, but it's particularly gone to the top 1%. And the higher up within that 1% you go, the bigger the economic gains are. So, for instance, 30 years ago, the average CEO typically had an income that was 20 to 30 times the average wage. Today, that gap is that the average CEO has an income that's roughly 200 to 300 times the average wage. The top hedge fund managers in the financial business, you know, the gap is even more extreme. For instance, here's one statistic that always stuns me. In 2009, like that's after the financial crash, the top 25 hedge fund managers earned on average, $1 billion each, okay? And that, by the way, is not 200 or 300 times the average wage. That is 24,000 times the average wage. And by the way, some of these numbers are American. The case has been most extreme in the United States, but it has been very much the case here in Canada as well. In the last dozen years in Canada, for instance, while the incomes of ordinary people have been stagnant, and you may not feel that the incomes are stagnant, but you probably do feel that they're stagnant. But in case you're doubting that, don't forget that people in the middle class are basically working twice as hard as they did earlier because, of course, they have two incomes, whereas 30 years ago it was not unusual to have a single family income, or one income for a family. Anyway, while this has basically been stagnant among ordinary people, in Canada in the past dozen years, the incomes of the top 50 CEOs have risen on average by 440%. Just a staggering increase at the top. And our sense, and I'm sure you got this clearly from Neil, is our sense is this is just a dramatic change. This is a dramatic change that cries out for some kind of justification. You know, you fundamentally change how money is distributed among the people in society, and nobody kind of even comments on it. And you raise it and you're considered some kind of weird radical or something. We think it absolutely cries out for justification. Now, to the extent that there is a justification out there in the business press, it tends to be that the people at the top have to have these big incentives, right? They have to have the incentives so that they will perform to optimal capacity, that this is really necessary for the success of our economy. So you would think, given the huge rewards at the top, that the performance must be just staggering. I think you know where I'm going with this. Let's just give you a couple of quick, fun examples. That in 2009, after the terrible financial crash, the head of Merrill Lynch gave their top executives $4 billion worth of bonuses. This is right after this top team had just steered the company to $29 billion in losses. And I think some reporter asked him, you know, why are you doing this? And he said, well, we have to do this to keep our most talented people. Which makes you wonder what some of the less talented people they had might have done. But our point is that when you look through the evidence, there's just simply no evidence of a justification for this enormous run-up at the top. Today's top earners are not more talented, they're not more creative, they're not more hardworking than the top earners were 30 years ago. They're not worth 200 or 300 times what the average income person is working. They're certainly not worth 24,000 times what the average worker is earning. In fact, we argue that there's no justification. What basically has happened is there's been simply a kind of a coup, that in effect what's happened is, you know, this concentration of income at the top, this huge income, it is the result of a, you know, massive, masterful political campaign to get more for themselves. And how did they do it? Well, you know what? I'm going to throw in a list here. Okay? Well, I'm just going to quickly say that, Neil, four items I want to draw your attention to. Basically, this is our point, that it's not something haphazard. It's a deliberate campaign. And we identify, for instance, changes in CEO compensation, stock options principally, very, very key factor in driving up wages. Changes in ideology, the ideology of neoliberalism that basically encouraged the encouragement of greed and accumulation at the top, and the kind of tolerance for greed in society, which was not the case 30 years ago. Changes, very crucial changes in the tax system that drove taxes down for people at the upper end. And also, fourthly, the changes that have disempowered labor, because by disempowering labor, that has empowered capital and has allowed capital to basically trample on the rights of so many working people. And so what we argue basically is that this enormous concentration of wealth at the top, it's kind of a scam really what's happened. And partly the reason it's a scam is because they haven't been honest. You know, the group at the top that have orchestrated this big change, it's not as if they came out and said, well, you know, we're greedy, we would like more. They don't say that. Instead, they couch it in terms of it's an economic necessity. You have to do this. You have to cut taxes on the rich. If you don't cut taxes on the rich, you will destroy the economic performance of your country. You'll gut economic growth. You'll limit economic growth. And therefore, in the interest of all of us, we have to cut taxes on the rich. That's the way they sold it to us. Well, as Neil has pointed out, that, next time somebody makes that argument to you, one of the things you can say is, well, after you say, go Flames, go, you know, then the next thing you say is that, in fact, high taxes, there's no evidence that high taxes actually do anything to destroy economic growth because, in fact, if you look at that post-war period, 1945 to 1980, the taxes on the rich, as Niels mentioned, were incredibly high. The marginal tax rates were 80 and 90%, both in Canada and the United States. And yet both in Canada and the United States, those were the periods of greatest economic growth in our countries. There were vibrant capitalist economies. So you cannot argue that the high taxes destroyed economic growth. It is simply refuted by the evidence. And in fact, strikingly, since the taxes have been reduced since 1980, and they have been dramatically reduced since 1980, you know, we mentioned there was marginal tax rates as high as 80 and 90 to, in fact, above 90% some years, they're now down to the top marginal tax rate is 46%. Dramatic reduction. And yet, since that's happened, economic growth has slowed down as well. So the lower taxes since 1980 have not produced the big cornucopia that we're always told about. Now, the other big argument, of course, they always come out with is that if you have high tax on the rich, they'll leave, right? They'll leave. Well, you know, I was going to say, you know, when people say that, and your point is, you know. But, you know, this is actually a huge topic, and since Neil talked so long, I don't really have the time to get into it. But let me just say, some will go. They will, and they'll be very noisy when they go. The truth is, most won't go, because most people actually make decisions in their lives for more reasons than just the rate of tax. You know, they like to live in a country because their family's here, their friends, whatever. We actually have some interesting arguments in the book about how to deal with the problem of tax havens. But, and maybe we can talk about that in the question period, but I won't get into that now. But I guess the real point I wanted to make is just simply to raise the point. It's interesting the way we just let them hold us hostage like that. I mean, imagine if another group in society, not the rich, another group, let's say plumbers, you know, or electricians or something, threatened to leave the country unless we did exactly what they wanted. You know, would we immediately kind of submit to them and just do what they wanted? I mean, it just seems a curious kind of approach that we don't think, isn't this odd that we're being demanded to do these things? And if we don't, you know, they're going to threaten to leave, and that we sort of think, well, then we better do it. I have this whole thing I want to talk about, why Bill Gates doesn't deserve his fortune. But I think maybe I don't have time. Do I have time? Or,
yeah.
Not many Bill Gates fans here tonight. Okay. Well, all right. What I want to say then is that today's concentration of income at the top is a reflection of what we called, or what could be called, the great man theory, right? The idea that, you know, there's certain individuals who are just so talented and so much better than the rest of us that kind of all by themselves they make great things happen. And, you know, if they were to leave the country, we'd barely be able to figure out how to turn the lights on. And this notion is therefore, you know, that because these people are so talented, they really deserve their billions. And in fact, this kind of theory is often advanced by billionaires. So for instance, here's just a couple of billionaires. Here's Leo Hendry, who invented a sports cable TV network. He said, I think there are some people, including myself, who are, because of their uniqueness, warrant whatever the market will bear. One of the things I like about billionaires is their modesty. Or here's Sanford Vail, a big Wall Street tycoon. He says, the last 25 years is an incredibly unique period. We didn't rely on somebody else to build what we built. We did it ourselves. Really, really, really. That's an interesting thought. So in other words, if Sanford Vail had been abandoned at birth on a desert island, he would have built his fortune up, goddamn, exactly the same way that he did, right? Well, maybe not. And so the the interesting thing is that, you know, we would argue that if he could build up that fortune all by himself, abandoned on a desert island, then he should be able to keep every single bit of it because he did it all himself. But if he couldn't reproduce it all on his own, then I think it's reasonable to ask the question, how much did he create and how much did other people create? Because the great man theory always leaves out the role of society, right? It always leaves out the role of every other person in the great man's life. The people that nurtured that person, that educated him, that created the society that allowed him to thrive. And most crucially, what it leaves out is the technological inheritance from the past that enabled his breakthrough to happen. And so here we come to Bill Gates. Now, Bill Gates is credited with inventing the operating system of the personal computer. But that was only possible because of all the advances that had happened before that. In fact, the computer itself had already been invented by the time Bill Gates was born. So every advance that led to the development of the computer and every advance before that, going all the way back to the beginning of, you know, the invention of the wheel, every advance builds on the other. And the truth is, Bill Gates could never, of course, have invented the personal computer if all those advances hadn't come before. So the notion, you know, we didn't really rely on somebody else, we did it all ourselves, it's just ludicrous. Every individual relies on thousands of individuals in society and historically many more tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. In fact, it's been calculated that this technological inheritance is responsible for something like 90% of the wealth that's generated today. It's just an immense inheritance. So the question is, who does that inheritance belong to? Who should be the beneficiary of all that technological development from the past? Well, under our current system, Bill Gates gets virtually all the benefits from the personal computer, even though he only really was involved in the very last stage of the development. Oh, and by the way, here's another kind of cute irony. Bill Gates actually didn't invent the operating device of the personal computer. Actually, it was another guy. It was Gary Kildall. And Bill Gates knew Gary Kildall, but he managed to kind of elbow him out of the way and get the contract with IBM instead. And in fact, that kind of thing is typical, because the way science works is that one advance leads to another. And when a scientific breakthrough happens, the next stage is kind of obvious and more or less inevitable to the relatively small number of people that are working in that field. So with or without Bill Gates, we would have had the personal computer. We would have had it because of the technological inheritance from the past. So the point is, why should $53 billion be in Bill Gates' pocket rather than sharing a larger amount of that through taxation with society at large? And we have in the book a number of ideas about how we can increase the taxes. And, you know, again, when you say this kind of thing, when you talk about increasing taxes on the rich, for instance, we suggest that there should be a new top marginal tax rate for incomes above $500,000. So probably not too many people in the room are going to be affected by that. But there are a number of Canadians making over $500,000 a year, and we think they should, once they reach $500,000, income above that should be taxed at the rate of 60%. And we think that with incomes above $2.5 million, and by the way, there's about 5,000 Canadians making $2.5 million a year, 59,000 making $500,000 a year, we think anything above $2.5 million should be taxed at 70%. Now, maybe that sounds onerous. If we have a choice, if we have to raise taxes on the rich, raise taxes on the rest of the population, or let government services decline because we don't have enough tax revenue, and therefore punish all the bulk of the population that relies on those programs, if we have those three choices, is raising taxes on the rich such an unreasonable one? I do want to quickly tell you one idea that we have for taxes, tax change that I think is really exciting, and I think you will find it exciting too, and that is to introduce an inheritance tax. We don't have an inheritance tax in Canada. We used to. It was quietly canceled in 1972. And we're one of the few countries in the Western world that doesn't have one. Okay, so what we propose is that inheritance is bigger. That you could inherit up to $1.5 million and pay no tax at all. So only going to be the top 1% that are affected by this, okay? So think about it. You get to get $1.5 million without paying any tax, which is interesting when you think about it, because when you earn income up to $1.5 million, you pay lots of tax on it, but we're going to give you an exemption on that first $1.5 million, which is unearned income. I mean, it's due to no skill, no talent, no effort on your part, only the skill of choosing the appropriate parents. You know, I mean, Warren Buffett has called this the ovarian lottery. And I think that's a suitable... But anyway, the exciting part of this is that once we get that money from the taxing people, you know, the top 1% inheritances, there will be enough revenue that we'll be able to set up educational trust funds for every Canadian child. So when every child turns 16, they will have $16,000 deposited into an educational trust fund to be used exclusively for education or training of that child. And you know, we just and in addition to what that will do for national productivity, it will simply do wonders for the notion that this is a inclusive community, that we care about people in our community, and that we actually believe in a concept like equality of opportunity. I think I'm going to wrap up here, but I want to leave you with some good news, okay? Because, you know, sometimes this seems a little down to be thinking of how, you know, how much the rich have gotten richer and how bad Neil's career is. But this is some very good news. And that is ordinary people, not even just people in this room, but even ordinary people out there, actually care about equality to a surprising extent. And the evidence I want to point to is there's an interesting study that just came out that was done by a couple of professors at Harvard. And they interviewed thousands, something like 5,000 typical Americans, randomly selected. Rich, poor, fat, thin, Republican, Democrat, everything. And there's a couple of things. One of the things they found, the issue they were interviewing them about was to do with inequality and distribution of wealth, okay? And the first thing they discovered is that Americans have absolutely no sense of how actually unequal their country is. They just have no sense whatsoever. And as the Harvard guys pointed out in here, even there were some economists that had been randomly selected, and they had no idea whatsoever either. So that's the first thing, that the actual level of inequality is unknown. But here's the really intriguing thing. Then the second part of the study was to determine, well, what would they like? What would Americans like to have as the level of inequality in their society? Like, how would they like the shares of the national income to be distributed among different segments of the population? And they did this in an intriguing way. They drew up sort of three, I guess you could call them pie charts, okay? And they just labeled them pie A, pie B, and pie C. Pie A was, although they didn't know this, the people doing this didn't know, like the Harvard people knew, but the ordinary people didn't know. Pie A represented the actual distribution of wealth in the United States. So very unequal, okay? Pie B represented the actual distribution of wealth in Sweden, okay? Pie C showed total equality. Well, you know what? It turned out 90% of the Americans, randomly selected, rich, poor, fat, thin, everything, selected as their preferred choice of how wealth should be distributed, Pi B, Sweden. Of course, they didn't know it was Sweden. If they'd known it was Sweden, they would have rejected it. It would be socialism, and they wouldn't have had anything to do with it. But that is the reality. 90% actually favored that fair distribution of income. Now, that's an American study. But if anything, I think Canada would probably even more that way. And I do have a little bit just quickly to say about Canada. You know, there is lots of evidence that Canadians do care deeply about social programs and care about social programs more than tax cuts. Sure, if you ask them, do you want a tax cut? You know, do you want some chocolate? Do you want some ice cream? You know, they say, yeah, I do. But if you force them to choose, if you say, do you want a tax cut or do you want social reinvestment? Do you want your money spent reinvested in health care, education, pensions, etc.? Overwhelmingly, by margins actually above 80%, Canadians will tell you they want social reinvestment. You know, and this is maybe a little surprising because we tend to think, you know, if you just observe what's going on out there, you tend to think from reading the media that everybody out there is suffering from tax rage. You know, it turns out, in fact, very, very few Canadians are actually suffering from tax rage. In fact, I can tell you, it's really just a small group. It's rich, older men. And I actually have some evidence to back this up. I'm not just making that accusation. My evidence is there's a publication that comes out in the National Post from time to time. It's a weird little publication. It's called The Wealthy Boomer, a very strange publication. It consists of just two things, articles about tax rage and ads for Viagra. You know, which leads me to wonder, you know, does tax rage cause erectile dysfunction? Or does erectile dysfunction cause tax rage? But anyway, my point is that the right is impotent. Actually, sadly, that is not true. The right is not impotent. But my real point is neither are we. And the point is that it's time that we actually started standing up and fighting to make this a more equal society. Thank you very much.
Radio EcoShock.
That was the thorn in the side of the wealthy, journalist and author Linda McQuaig. She was speaking at the Vancouver Public Library with tax professor Neil Brooks to announce their new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. Now you know, and knowing is half the battle.
Its purpose, to defend human freedom against Cobra, a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world.
He never gives up. He'll stay till
the most disgusting and outrageous act of financial terrorism we've seen in decades. And I'm speaking, of course, of the central banks inflating the money supply.
One of the problems we have now in not having a recovery is that all the money is up there at the top. There is not enough money out there in general circulation. And as long as you have that population, you know, the general population without money in their pockets, going to spend and buy things, businesses are not interested in investing. So if nothing more, in order to stimulate economic growth, get the economy moving, we need to redistribute. We can't just have the money concentrated at the top.
The other half is to reclaim our democracy and social justice. My thanks to the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives for organizing this event and allowing me to record it. Find out more about them at policyalternatives.ca.
That was The Trouble with Billionaires, as recorded by Alex Smith at the Public Library in Vancouver in the fall of 2010. Find more in the show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and if his voice returns, so will Alex Smith next week.